Hello, everybody. My name is Manny. I am an alcoholic. And I want to thank Melissa for giving me the spiel on the do's and don'ts tonight. And I want to thank Avery and Susan for keeping time, and Avery for holding the mic. And most importantly, I want to thank my friend Cynthia for ensuring my sobriety this evening by asking me to do service. And like I said, my name is Manny, and I am an alcoholic. And before we go any further, just so there's no misunderstanding as to what I mean when I say my name is Manny and I am an alcoholic, if you can indulge me for a second, I'm going to read just a couple of paragraphs from page 21 in our basic text that kind of, you know, just tells you exactly what I mean when I say that my name is Manny and I am an alcoholic. So if you can indulge me for just one second. Okay, here, what about the real alcoholic? Right? And it goes, here is the fellow who has been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. He is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He is always more or less insanely drunk. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature, but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, but yet let him drink for a day and he becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. You know, I could go on reading that, but I guess you get the gist of what I mean when I say my name is Manny and I am an alcoholic. It also goes on to say that, you know, he is the fellow who drinks the clock around, and he's so intoxicated he ought to sleep the clock around. But that was me, you know. I opened the floodgates by having the first drink, and then once the phenomenon of craving took over, the obsession and compulsion took over, and I was off to the races. So, my sobriety date is March the 24th, 2000, and my home group is the 3rd and 11th step group in Bogota, New Jersey. We meet on Sundays at 11:30 in the morning, and here in the city is the 8:30 p.m. Perry Street group on Friday nights. My sponsor is Mike R, the original Mike R, not the sweet and spicy Mike R that Cynthia and I know. And my grand sponsor is Miles D, and my great grand sponsor is Richard, right? And then I sponsor three guys, and then two of them sponsor their great. They're grant sponsors, so that would make me a great grant sponsor. And I tried to explain that to Miles the other day, and he almost had a heart attack. You know, his mind almost blew up. But anyway, the reason I mentioned that is because it's important to illustrate that there's continuity to my recovery. Right, there's consistency, there's continuity, and I have a home group, I have a sponsor, I sponsor guys, I'm involved in my own recovery, and by the grace of God, I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink in 15 and a half years. So let's get to it, right? My last drink was at an after hours on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, right? Around a corner from that lovely deli that we all love, Katz's Deli, right? Nice pastrami sandwiches. Well, right around the corner from there, there was an after-hours club appropriately named Godzilla's, right? And, you know, I pulled up to Godzilla's, you know, at 6:30 in the morning, you know, on a Friday, right? A work day. Everybody's going to work, right? And here I am, and I walk into Godzilla's, and there's 150 people dancing, you know, so I know I don't have a problem, right? I mean, you know, really, I mean, you're at a place during the week when everybody's going to work and there's 150 people jumping up and down. How can I possibly have a problem? And, you know, and the reason I mention that is because, you know, the denial in my disease, you know, manifested itself in many ways. And one of the ways that it manifested itself was in if everybody else is doing it, I can't have a problem. you know, and that's the ugly lie that I, as an alcoholic, I told myself over and over and over again, right? That insanity of doing the same things over and over again, expecting different results that the second step talks about. In any case, I pulled up to the bar of this lovely after hours, and I asked the bartender for a drink. And so the bartender places this drink in front of me with a big fat straw sticking out of it. And as he's doing that, New York's finest decides to raid the place. Okay, so the lights go on, the music stops, and they order everybody to put their hands over their heads. And so I'm being patted down, like this is in a matter of seconds, by a very nice patrolman who's patting me down. But yet, I haven't had a drink in about an hour, and there's that drink in front of me with a big fat straw sticking out of it. So if you're a real alcoholic, you can surmise 1 + 1 = I drank that drink while I was being patted down. And and that got me like a smack on the head and a billy club to the leg, you know. And, you know, it's important to tell you why I, we're not a glum lot, right? But it's important to tell you why I tell that story. And the reason that I tell that story is because the consequences to my drinking had become irrelevant. That whatever the outcome of having that drink in front of a police officer who's searching me was irrelevant. Consequences had no longer played a part in my drinking. Whatever will be, right? Doris Day, que será, será, right? And so, didn't care what would happen, what the repercussions of my alcoholism were. They were, you know, I'll deal with it tomorrow, right? Another song, Mañana, Mañana, Mañana. But, the book talks about, you know, frothy emotional appeals, you know. My mother asking me, please stop, you know, when I was 13 years old, you know, making me get on my knees and pray over a saint and saying, please stop. And, you know, and I did, you know, for a little while till that wore off. And then, you know, the desire came back, you know. So forth the emotional appeals. Knowledge didn't keep me sober. Consequences didn't keep me sober. Self-will, God. You know, I'm a professional stopper drinker, right? I'm a professional at it. If there was an Olympics for stopping, I would get a gold medal, you know. But the question was, can I stay stopped? That's the important, you know, life and death question. You know, can I stay stopped? And I couldn't. I couldn't. I needed, you know, I was beyond human aid, right? We read about beyond human aid, you know, no human power, right? ABCs, right? No human power could have relieved my alcoholism. And in my case, God could and would when I seek him, right? But that's for a little later. You know, so here I am being patted down. I drink this drink and, you know, obviously, you know, I get escorted out and I knew the drill. This was not my first time at the rodeo with being thrown out of an after hours in Manhattan. OK, this was a part of doing what I did. Right. And so I get escorted out and there's a very nice NYPD sergeant outside asking for ID. Right. And so at the time, you have to understand, I was not an ID kind of carrying guy, you know, I just didn't have any, you know. So I mentioned it to the sergeant that I didn't have ID. And he looked at me with that New York cop sarcastic smile. And he said, you also don't own a comb, right? And, you know, I looked at him and, you know, at that time, right, I was cutting my own hair to save some money to get more drinks. But I thought I looked good. I wore a tweed jacket. I thought I looked good. But in reality, I was a mess. And, I saw that movie, The English Patient, and the actress Juliette Binoche was cutting her own hair in that movie. So I got the brilliant idea. Maybe I could do that, save some bucks so I can drink some more. So one side of my head was longer than the other. It was, you know, I was a mess. I had rings under my eyes. I was bloated. And it was not a pretty sight. And more importantly than that, inside, I was dead. Right? It's an inside job, right? We talk about it. It's an inside job. So I was dead inside. And so, you know, that remark really bothered me. You know, imagine that, an alcoholic catching a resentment. So, you know, it really bothered me. So I walked to my car, and my uninsured, unregistered, fictitious plate vehicle, and I got into this vehicle, and I'm adjusting the rearview mirror. You know, the only documentation in that car was a wad of McDonald's napkins and the pink slip. It was legal. I did actually buy it from somebody. So, but other than that, it was literally a moving violation, that call. So I get into this vehicle, and I'm adjusting the rearview mirror, and I get a glimpse of my face, right? I get a glimpse of my face for what it had become, what I had become. I get this moment, like we talk about and we've read about, the moment of clarity. It wasn't a spiritual experience. That didn't come till step work time, but it was a moment of clarity. It was a significant moment of clarity, because at this particular moment, when I'm adjusting that rearview mirror, I get the full brunt of my face and all the implications that came with it, meaning the, wasting of years and years and decades, really. I mean, alcoholics, we burn decades like most people burn months, And so I, get this feeling, this overwhelming sensation at that moment when I'm looking at this hideous creature looking back at me. You know, I was living a nocturnal existence, it was not a pretty sight. So I had this overwhelming sensation that I needed to stop. This has got to stop. And I could not live like this any longer. And I was at that jumping off point that we read about in the literature. I could no longer live with it, and I could no longer live without it. And the great thing about that was that for whatever reason, and I don't believe in coincidences, back in the mid-80s, I used to work at a restaurant, 57th Street, very popular restaurant, the Russian Tea Room. And I was a waiter there, right? I used to work there in the mid-80s when the place was jumping. And I was a waiter there, and I would waltz in the morning, right, all hungover. And there was a little old man that worked the bar there, and he would always have that smile. You know that smile that we get when we see somebody that's not, that's drunk, and we say, thank you, God, that's not me. That smile, that little crack of the lips. Thank you. Anyway, he always had that with me. He looked at me. I would waltz in, and I would be all, discombobulated, the uniform out of whack, and the whole nine yards. And so, he would have that smile. And so one day, he called me over, and he said, listen, you're pretty hungover, right? And I said, I am. I really am. I tied one on last night. And, like every night, right? This is like Groundhog Day for me. And this was like 1986. Anyway, so he made me this concoction. It was like a hangover concoction. It had no booze in it. It had like beef broth and celery and all this disgusting stuff. And I drank it. And, I thought it made me feel better. So I thanked him. And I said, how do you know so much about like that stuff? I mean, I know you're a bartender. And he says, well, I used to be an alcoholic, or I am an alcoholic. I used to drink a lot. And I would wind up face first on the street in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And one day, a couple guys helped me out, and I got sober in 1960. So I said, really? Okay. And you're a bartender? And that was it. That was the crux of my conversation with that guy. And 14 years later, that mustard seed that he planted in me came back to me and said, Manny, if that little old guy got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe you can get sober. True story. So I made a deal with myself right there on the spot that I would ask you guys for help, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I made a deal that I would give it a shot. And I had never done that. I had never gone to rehab, detox. Those are yets for me, except on speaking commitments. So I made that deal with myself. So I went home that morning to my basement apartment in Fairview, New Jersey. You know, I used to put big giant pillows on the windows so people wouldn't, for the light wouldn't come in. It was a hideous existence. And so I went to that apartment, and for the next 3 days, I didn't drink and I didn't do all the substances, and it wasn't pretty. Let me tell you, it was not a pretty sight. I don't recommend it. I was not learned in the detox and all of that kind of stuff. I really wasn't. I was just out there, man. And so, you know, it wasn't a pretty sight, but God looked after me. And 3 days later, I came, you know, I woke up, and I had still had that resolve that I would ask you guys for help. And you know, Tom Wolfe, the author Tom Wolfe, wrote many, many years ago that you could never go home again. And I tried to dispel Mr. Wolfe's assertion that I couldn't go home again. So I went home to Hoboken, New Jersey. And, you know, I got in my unregistered, uninsured, fictitious plate vehicle with no driver's license. And I drove from Fairview, New Jersey to Hoboken, about a 25-minute ride. And I parked the car, and I went to the meeting, and there was a guy named Kevin B. at the door, right? I always say at the door, like I'm using club references, right? I got to keep coming, man. Anyway, so Kevin is their greeter. He was a greeter. And so Kevin came up to me, and he gave me a hug, and he told, and you know, I got to tell you, at that time in my life, I was not the huggable type, all right? I was not getting a lot of hugs. So Kevin gave me a hug, and he told me, Manny, if you keep coming, it gets better. What I didn't know at the time was that the it was me. That I would get better if I kept coming. And boy, was he right. And so I walked into that meeting, and I don't remember much except for a couple of things about that meeting. I know that I sat on my hands, and I rocked back and forth. And by the way, I did that for the next 30-something days. But at that meeting, there was a young lady leading the meeting, and her name was Cynthia. And she was the chairperson of that meeting, you know. And there was a gentleman there named Al, and Al is sober many, many years, and he's still around. So, and Kevin is, although, you know, he's no longer a member, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. In any case, that was my journey. That's where it started. And from there on, you know, I took to Alcoholics Anonymous like a fish to water. I really did. I was, you know, if you told me to stand on top of the Empire State Building on my head and that would keep me sober, I would have done it. And I started making meetings. If your butt falls off, pick it up, put it on, and go to a meeting. I started hanging out with real hardcore people that didn't fool around. There was a lady at the 1215 Englewood meeting. Her name was Zell. God rest her soul. And Zell died 42 years sober a couple of years back. And she was like my mentor. I loved her, and she showed me a lot of hardcore AA, and she was like no nonsense. And so I had good winners in my corner. People, you know, people see that you're working hard on your recovery. They levitate towards you. They just do. That's just the way it is. And so, you know, I took a commitment at this Englewood meeting as a greeter, right? And I was so gung-ho about it. I cleaned myself up. I came with a sports jacket. I thought I was a maitre d' at a restaurant. You know, party of two right this way, you know. But literally, you know, the word commitment. I really took it serious. And what really was so fantastic about that is that it grounded me in the group. Everybody that was walking in the door, I said, hi, my name is Manny. Welcome. You know, and they got to know me. And then like all these strangers all of a sudden, like within like a month, would say, hey, Manny, how are you? And I said, how the hell does he know my name? You know, but that was it. That was the hook that the second step talks about, at least for me. That power greater than myself, you know, the hope, H-O-P-E, man. That is a big word in my recovery, hope. And that was the hook that I bit into. I saw you guys going to movie theaters, going camping, going rafting, going canoeing, going to the movies, working. And you were doing it all without getting smashed. Without getting smashed. And that was hope. And that was the hook that this fish bit into. And when I bit into that hook, you guys little by slowly started to reel me in. with love. That, you know, there's a little sign on the mustard seed on 37th off of Lex that says, "We will love you till you learn how to love yourself." And you guys loved me till I learned how to love myself. And how did I learn how to love myself? By working with a sponsor who took me through the steps and getting rid of all that garbage. All that garbage. My sponsor told me, "Manny, your house is dirty. You got to clean it. It stinks. There's rotten fish in there. The refrigerator's got mold in it." You know, and metaphorically speaking, he was right on the money. Also literally. So I went to work, and I went to work on the steps with him. He grabbed me, and he guided me. He was a loving, he's still my sponsor. He's a loving, caring man, and he introduced me to the steps, and I got busy writing an inventory, and then I started to procrastinate a little bit. And I'll never forget my grand sponsor, Miles, who was not my grand sponsor at the time, used to say, "How you doing with that fourth step?" I would say, "I'm working on it, Miles. I'm working on it." I said, all right. So one day, you know, this girl in my home group went out, and I found out that she hadn't worked the fourth step. And that really, you know, put things, it crystallized what my purpose was right now. And that was to, you know, I went home, and I was living with my parents. They were living, in a beautiful apartment overlooking New York skyline, and they had me on their couch. And I started writing that fourth step. And I started, like, at 10 o'clock at night. And it's funny because I had the Hazelden Guide, the big book, the little Hazelden Guide, the big Hazelden Guide. I had my yellow Adirondack number 2 pencils all sharpened because I was procrastinating. You know, I had the 12 and 12 the whole night. And then finally when I went home that night that I was actually had the resolve to do it, I knocked everything off the table, and I took a pen and a legal pad, and I did it exactly how it's outlined in the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I finished writing around 5 o'clock in the morning. I had the carpal tunnel, the pen in the hand thing going, but I called my sponsor, right? Hey, now, just imagine, this guy's sober about 11 years at the time, with the family, sleeping at 5 a.m., and here's this pink cloud guy. "Hey, Mike, I just finished my fourth step." Click, you know. He met me that morning at a sober house, and we sat together, and he heard my story. And he told me, "Manny, if they have a name for it, somebody did it before you." And so, you know, that terminal uniqueness that I was carrying for so many years started to dissipate. He went toe-to-toe with me on everything that I had there, and it just made me feel like I was part of, you know. And at the end of that, I took an hour to contemplate the previous steps, and, got to work, you know. When I did a seventh step, you know, there was a suggestion given to me, "Oh, put your character defects in." And so I went to a party box, and I got a helium balloon, and I wrote out all my character defects. I threw it in a helium balloon. I let it go in the parking lot. Very symbolic, very beautiful, right? So I go to a meeting, and I share about it, and some guy shares, "You know that balloon, man, he's going to come back down to earth, right?" You know, and that's really that's Alcoholics Anonymous in a nutshell, man, you know. And so, you know, I did that list, and that list came directly from that fourth step, and I made amends. I remember my brother didn't speak to me for 6 years. He used to tell my mother, "Let me know when he's coming. I don't want to be there." And I remember, you know, I started my amends. My first amends, I did 6 days in jail, right? Hudson County Jail. Believe me, not a place you want to go to. All right, I've heard guys in Rikers Island say, "I would never go back to Hudson County Jail again." That's how bad it is. So anyway, I hadn't spoken to my brother in 6 years. So I'm laying on the beach in southern Spain, in Fuengirola, Spain. I guess I'm about 14 months sober. And I listened to a song that reminded me of my brother, and I started crying. So right then and there, I got up, and I went. I bought an international phone card, right? I'm dating myself. And I went, and I called my brother, and my sister-in-law answered, and she said, "I've been waiting for this call for 6 years." And she put him on, and there was like, hello, and then dead silence, you know. And then I went on to, clean my side of the street, not his. And, you know, we have a good relationship today. You know, we're not like the super bros, but we love each other and we have respect for each other. And we have each other's family in our lives. You know, I can tell you that, you know, I live in 10, 11, and 12, or I try to the best of my ability. I sponsor guys. I give it to God as much as possible. What Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me, I could sit here for 17 hours straight, and I only got 5 minutes, to tell you how much I love you guys, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous and what you've done for me. When I was drinking, you know, I traveled to Europe a bunch of times. You know, my father's from Spain, so I was able to go to Spain many times, and, you know, Portugal, et cetera. And all those vacations were horror shows. In sobriety, I've done a lot of traveling. I spoke in Italy and Rome 4 years ago. I've been to the Paris, you know, the American Cathedral, the American Church, wonderful meetings, you know, all over southern Spain, Portugal, Italy, you know, southern France. You know, I went to a meeting in southern France a couple of years ago. It was the No Whining Group. You know, you gotta love it. I was in Madrid. I was actually in Spain last month, and I went to a couple of great meetings in Madrid. You know, I mean, beyond my wildest dreams, you know, my life, you know, hey, just because I got sober, I still got to pay my mortgage. I still got to live life on life's terms. And let me tell you something. Life can be pretty hard sometimes, okay? It could give you a nice big kick in the tuchus. But I'll tell you this. I wouldn't trade a minute in Alcoholics Anonymous the last 15 and a half years for all my nights at Studio 54 in 78 and 79. You know, I wouldn't, because this is the best show in town. You guys saved my bacon. You gave me a life with my parents. My mother passed away 6 years ago. She got to see her boy sober. What a gift you guys gave me, right? To my mother to see me sober. This is a woman who used to bring her pocketbook into the shower with her. Right? She danced. You know, I met my wife in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, page 117, boy meets girl in AA campus, right? And, you know, we had 106 people at our wedding, right? 80 of them were from recovery. You know, that's it. And we had open bar. You know, as far as I know, the 80 didn't drink, you know, and you know, we had a wonderful time, you know. I can go on forever about the gifts that you guys have given me, you know. This Sunday, I'm going rafting with 29 other guys, sober. We started this thing 3 years ago, right? Sponsee, newcomer, rafting trip. And it started with 14 guys. Last year it was 20. Now it's 30, and we had to turn down a few because they wouldn't let us bring more. Okay? The joys of sobriety. Bill wrote, you know, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. Absolutely. Right? So I stand here today as a byproduct of what those two guys did 80 years ago. You know, I've been fortunate. I've been to Akron a couple times. I was at the 75th anniversary of AA in Akron. I saw the motorcycle procession. I cried like a baby. I've been to East Dorset many times, and I've been to Stepping Stone many times. To me, those are the troikas, right? And I love AA. I love everything about it. I love the styrofoam cups. I love the Turkish coffee. I love the... You know, I love the drunkologues, the guy that does not stop talking. You know, I love it all. I love it all. Because all of that contributes to me staying sober one day at a time, whether I know it or not. You know, I've been blessed. And I have a friend of mine. His name is Ronnie. He's sober many, many years. And whenever I ask Ronnie, how are you doing, Ronnie? Ronnie says, too blessed to be stressed, Manny. Too blessed to be stressed. And if you look at Ronnie, he really does. He really does look like he's blessed. He's got that face, you know, like. And, you know, I wouldn't call him like Kane from Kung Fu, but he's really pretty relaxed guy. you know. Anyway, you know, I'll finish with this. You know, you know, if nobody told you they love you today, I love you, man. And thank you for saving my bacon. Thank you very much, Atlantic Group, for having me here and for listening.